I need to make an important clarification. In an earlier version of this episode, I responded to a question about a controversy in the Mooresville Police Department, specifically an article published earlier this year about two higher-ups in the department having been suspended pending an internal investigation. In discussion of the topic in the article specifically, I said that I knew the lead investigator from the Mooresville Police Department had been under investigation himself in 2018. It's come to my attention that some have interpreted this as me saying that the investigator in charge of Matt Stewart's murder case has been under investigation. This is not what I was suggesting. I was referring to the supervisor of all criminal investigations. I realize now that I should have been more specific and that my terminology was incorrect or misleading. And for that, I apologize. I said in the episode, and I'll say again, I don't know if there's any connection with the internal personnel investigation and Matt Stewart's murder case. There clearly doesn't appear to be any direct connection. However, I said before, and I still believe, that the controversy in the department is relevant to those interested in getting justice for Matt. It furthers the argument that definitive action to regain the confidence of the community in this specific case is necessary. As I said, releasing more information to the public or publicly inviting in experts to analyze the facts of this case are some ideas of what I think could serve this purpose. I digress. The main point being, I said lead investigator when I should have said and meant to say supervisor of criminal investigations. And I'm sorry for the confusion. I'm Freddie, host of Unforgotten, a podcast series which dives into the 2009 unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. The following is a special question and answer episode featuring a conversation recorded earlier this week between myself and Steve, moderator of the Unforgotten Forum. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum located at unforgotten.freeforums.net. So we are here at the inaugural question and answer special episode. The idea for this season is that after every regularly scheduled episode, we will follow it up with a question and answer where listeners can submit questions on the Unforgotten Forum or on Facebook or wherever, and we will address those questions and comments in the follow-up Q&A. Folks are a part of this. We're all figuring this out together.
Hey, Freddie. So I'm going to jump right in with some of the questions from the forum. One of the things that was sort of a theme with people that I had spoken with was a clarification. What kind of patients did Matt deal with in his role as a nurse? I know a lot of people seem to assume he was a pediatric nurse based on his love of children, and I was one of them. But this isn't quite accurate, is it?
The way that Amanda Collier described it to me, he was on a wing that had a lot of pediatric patients, but it had patients of all kinds, from my understanding.
Okay. And we had forum user Batman ask, has Matt's nursing license ever been investigated by the state nursing board? And is there a way to see if there were complaints lodged against him?
My answer to both of those questions is I don't know.
How would we even go about following up with something like that?
We need to talk to some nurses. Some nurses who would know need to listen to this and then get at me, unforgottenpod@gmail.com.
Well, hopefully we get some nibbles on that. He had a follow-up question as well. On the night of the murder, was everyone at the hospital working their shifts as expected? And were there any suspects from the hospital ever considered that you're aware of?
I mean, that's one of the questions that I asked was, you know, was there someone at the hospital that worked there that maybe had a dispute with him? She said, from the best of her recollection, she could not think of anyone really that had a problem with Matt at all. So nothing to my knowledge. But again, like I said in the episode, it's still kind of an uncharted territory for the most part. I probably talked to a dozen or so of people that worked with Matt. Of that, probably half of them only knew him in passing.
really hoping that more people come forward and have conversations with me and tell their story. It's just always illuminating to me to get one more person's perspective.
Sure, sure. Okay, user Robbie D. asked, shortly after Matt's death, there was a big scandal at the hospital regarding Medicare fraud. Has this been looked at to see if there could be some possible connection to Matt, possibly even as a potential whistleblower that might have made him a target?
We had, I think, stumbled across an article that detailed a little bit of what had happened, and that was after his murder, and it was odd. You know, until I read that, what he wrote in full, Robbie D., I really hadn't thought too much about Matt's possible involvement, but that's not to say that it shouldn't be looked into more thoroughly. It's just from a layman's understanding, it was kind of my assumption that he would not have been at the level in the hospital. He was not an administrator or dealing so much in the finances of things. There may be folks that are listening that have a better understanding of what a fraud situation like that may have involved. And if so, certainly reach out to me. It piqued my interest when I saw that post. That's what's great about the forum, is that we're able to bounce these ideas off and things we'd never thought of before. It may be worth the Freedom of Information Act request or two to learn, I guess, more about what was going on exactly. It's odd, you know, there's a few articles about it, but it's not like it was extensively covered in the local press. Kind of like another situation I know.
And what situation was that?
The murder of Matt Stewart.
So I do remember when we first started talking about the case and I started doing some independent research on my own, that this Medicare fraud was one of the first things that popped up. And we talked about it a little bit then. This was months ago, but it didn't seem like something that would warrant following up for the same reasons you mentioned, because he didn't seem likely to be directly involved in it. But I do suppose it would be somebody at the nurse's level who would most easily identify if a patient was getting treatments that were deemed unnecessary. So I suppose it is possible that he did have some kind of information. The question really becomes, would it ever reach the point where somebody would feel that he needs to be murdered in order to keep it?
You know, the way that this individual was kind of describing how these things can go, it could be, you know, organized crime. And then if you remember the fifth episode last season, I asked that FBI profiler if it was his opinion that this appeared as to have been a professional hit. And his response was that exactly the opposite. It appeared to be a very unprofessional killing. The facts of the case and what we know about the murder scene just doesn't really appear like it was a professional hit. But that's not to say that it's not worth pursuing and looking into a little bit more. I think that it is. I want to go down every rabbit hole we can go down. It's not like there's mountains of documents on Matt Stewart's murder that we can dig into, like in other cases where there's been a trial or there's been more public, some of the documents related to the case. So we really have to take whatever we can get. And it is significant, I think, that there was a big fraud scandal at the hospital that he happened to work at just a few months after he was mysteriously murdered. I think we have to look into it.
And I think my initial thoughts that it seemed unlikely that somebody would go to his house and murder him over this by going upstairs and immediately targeting him, it just didn't feel like the kind of thing that would be handled that way. But it was pointed out that there was the possibility that Matt might have had documents or even electronic flash drives or something with evidence about this that would have been kept at the house that would have actually had the need for whoever was taking care of this thing to look for the evidence. Again, it doesn't seem very plausible to me, but you got to run down everything. All right. Several listeners were quick to point out that even with Matt's supervisor claiming that it would be very difficult for Matt to have stolen drugs, there are a lot of loopholes in a system like that which could have still allowed for it to happen. In fact, one forum member who worked there for 10 years, including when Matt was murdered, said that it was actually possible, even though they agreed that if Amanda said it didn't happen, then it probably didn't. Just to try to put this to bed a little more firmly, have you heard anything in any of your interviews that leads you to believe that this is still a possible aspect of Matt's life where there is more to explore?
I would say so. I've had conversations with folks this week that have opened the door to more curiosity in that regard, in terms of if his past could have been a contributing cause to his murder. I think that the overwhelming anecdotal testimony or the kind of witness character testimony from folks that knew him at the time of his murder is just so staunchly, there's no way that this had anything to do with his life. But at the same time, you have a situation that is kind of outlandish from the get-go, and you have to look at every angle of everything, and sometimes it can be uncomfortable. I'm not closing the door to any possibility. I'm running down everything that I get.
Now let's move on to some of the questions about the phone call, which generated a lot of buzz after the last podcast dropped. Hank Wallace asked, you mentioned something when talking about the phone call about a statement that the family wanted you to give. Several people picked up on that. What's that about?
So first of all, a lot of what I was referencing in terms of the contacts or episodes that have happened with the family, you know, this was happening during the release of those episodes back in the fall of last year, just so people have a bit of a reference there. The statement that I referenced was a call that happened before that with a family member who had basically instructed me to stop the podcast. In response to that, I expressed to this family member that if I abruptly stop this podcast, that's not necessarily going to stop people's curiosity into this case. It may actually have the opposite impact, that, you know, I can stop doing this, but it's not like somebody else can't start a podcast in response. And so basically their response was, well, what we want you to do is release a statement saying that the podcast is putting the family in danger and they're no longer comfortable and I'm no longer comfortable doing it. And then she added at the end, send that statement to us and then we'll approve it and then you can post it. So it wasn't like they came with a prepackaged statement. That would have been cooler, actually. I could have read it on the podcast, which would have been really cool. But they just basically instructed me to come up with a statement myself that I would then get approved by the family. It was really, really weird.
So this is something that we talked about last season, and I think it still holds true. But your opinion on having the family involved and to make statements through the podcast, has that changed? Are you still willing to have them comment on things publicly and you'll broadcast it unedited if that's what they choose?
Yeah, I that certainly. And my position throughout this has been, of course, I'm open and would love their input into the podcast. You know, if they wanted to make a statement unedited, I would certainly allow for that and would invite that. At the same time, I have to be clear with them and anyone else that regardless of who you are or what you've been through, I would not tolerate continued threats against me or anybody else. The reason I revealed the fact that that phone call and conversation had taken place was because I honestly felt like it is critical for the audience to understand, like, why this case hasn't ever been covered, is because this is what happens to people. You know, that's my take. So
I'd like to go a step further with that as well, that if any of the family members or anyone directly involved does not want to be involved in the podcast, but still wants a platform to speak to the people who listen to the podcast, I welcome anybody who wants to come onto the forums. It's a neutral zone that anyone can say what they choose. I won't take posts down unless somebody is being intentionally threatening or they are revealing information about others who deserve some level of privacy. So if you want to get your voice heard and make sure that the people who listen to the podcast have the opportunity to see your side of it and don't want to support the podcast, please feel that the forum is a place that you can go to and voice your opinions in a way that will not be edited by anyone else. Okay, following up, It's Me asked, did you call the police about the mother-in-law call and what were their reactions and have they followed up on it?
First of all, of course, I called the Mooresville Police Department and I let them know. And in full disclosure, this is not the first call that I had received. And, you know, they had asked me after I reported the first call, they had asked for me to continue to keep them abreast to if I was to get other calls. So I did my due diligence there. I don't know if I want to get into what they had to say. I may leave that to the coming episodes. But I'll just say this. This all happened in the end of September of last year. I would not have included the revelation about this phone call had I really thought that something was being done about it. You know, yeah, I'll leave it at that for now.
You also got a question from Travis. You stated on the last podcast and before that you believe the family knows more than they've shared. What specifically, besides the grandmother's telling you she knows the killer is still out there, has led you to that conclusion?
So when I first started doing this back in January, February of last year, and I started doing the interviews with basically the people that I already knew that were close to Matt through the church or, you know, Matt's daughter, what I was told over and over again is that there's been no progress with the investigation and they have no idea who the perpetrator could be or what could have been involved, what the motive could have been. Not that they knew that the police knew that, but that's what they knew, that they had no further knowledge about who could have been involved or what it could have been pertaining to, the reason that he was murdered. And I feel like my experiences after the episode started being released, the things that they communicated to me, specifically Matt's mother-in-law, insinuating that I should expect the murderer to be listening to the podcast, that they expressed to me that the police knew that this was a dangerous situation and that the person was still at large. The story changed from, we have no idea who this could have been. You know, it could have been Patrick Tracy Burris. It could have been, you know, somebody that passed away years ago. Now it's, they're under the assumption that this person is at large and dangerous. And that doesn't jive with what I was told just a matter of months ago. So I feel like I was not given the whole story.
That's a good segue to my next question. Many people seem to think that the police know what happened and how it all went down, but that there was either a terrible mistake made in the investigation that prevents them from prosecuting, or that they've reached a place where it would look extremely bad for the authorities if their early mistakes were known. Do you have any reason to think that this is a possibility?
I don't have any kind of substantial evidence that would prove that. I have anecdotes that would lead me to believe that, yeah. Personal testimony from people with close proximity to the situation or to law enforcement that have indicated that exactly what you said, that there's a good reason as to why, unlike many, 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 many other unsolved murder cases, instead of law enforcement using the media to continue to get the case on people's mind, they have purposefully suppressed the story due to something within the department.
So there have been articles published recently, as recent as this past week or two, suggesting that the Mooresville Police Department is under investigation for several things. What kind of things, and do you think this is related in any way to the case?
To me, whether it relates to the case or not, I think it furthers the argument that the Mooresville Police Department have expired on the trust of the community to thoroughly investigate this, and I believe they should take some definitive action, whether that's release more information that can explain why, from the outside looking in, it looks like they've been so neglectful, or to, in a very public way, invite in other experts that can assist them in completing this investigation. At this point, I think that it would be really detrimental to the trust of the public if they were to continue to not talk about this 10-year-old murder that was so vicious and heinous. Coming into the 10-year anniversary, they should no longer take the same failed strategy that they've taken in the last 10 years. They need to do something else.
So not only is the MPD currently under investigation, but there's been times in the past where they've been subjected to outside oversight because of issues.
Like when the former police chief was indicted on charges of embezzlement, and then there was other murders that have happened where there were some serious, well-documented missteps from the Mooresville Police Department. There's some serious questions that people can rightfully raise.
All right. Well, I think that's all I have for listener questions. So why don't I ask you one of my own? What do we have to look forward to for the next episode?
I think people are going to love it because it's you and me in Gabriel Estates neighborhood with a recorder talking to neighbors who have some really, really weird stories to tell. You know, after 10 years, memories can kind of fade. And it's always going to be a component of this looking back 10 years. But I think you could attest to the fact, too, that when you're sitting down with some of these folks and they saw some of the weird kind of unsettling things that they did, it's very compelling to hear somebody say, this is what I saw, and I'll never forget that because it was so eerie and so haunting.
Yeah, it was very interesting to talk to people who had specific recollections and to try to validate their memories with the facts that we've already learned from other sources. Memory is a tricky thing, and everyone remembers things a little bit differently, but when they have specific details that stuck in their mind, it's hard to discredit the things that they say.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We've got some interviews lined up with people that I've wanted the audience to hear their story for a very long time. And whether it would be that they never call me back until recently, or that for the longest time they weren't willing to go on the record, and then just now recently they said that they would. So I'm able to, for the first time, share some of these really bizarre encounters that people had.
One last question that just popped into my mind. Do you feel that people are opening up now more than they were when you started the podcast? Has the increased awareness of the case and the discussion in the community prompted more people to come forward?
Yeah, absolutely. For the most part, things aren't earth-shattering, but there are those that say, well, have you heard this? Or, you know, this is what happened to me on the morning of the murder. I had this encounter with this person. They said this, and that was really weird. There are times where I almost drop the phone.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up for this episode of Q&A. So hopefully we can get more questions after the next episode at unforgotten.freeforums.net. Anyone's welcome to join, make an account, and leave a question for us. You can also question Freddie directly through his email address.
So the email is unforgottenpod, that's unforgottenpod, @gmail.com.
And I believe your phone number is also on the website, isn't it?
It is. It's my Google Voice number. It's not my real phone number. I only give that out to friends. And pretty much anyone that asks on Facebook.
I don't know if that's going to make it.
No, probably not.
Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.